Hello, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. This week, regular host Fergus and Rob O'Sullivan talk with Dr. Joe Cohen, reader in American history at Queen Mary, University of London. Joe is a historian of consumerism, capitalism, and political economy in the 19th century. Joe will be discussing her paper, Hall's Sympathies, Loss, Law, and the Limits of Feeling in 19th Century America, which weaves together a history of emotion with a history of the law. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy.
So, Joe, hi. If we could just begin by asking where and when this paper situates us, what's the overarching story that it aims to tell, and where does it fit into current scholarship on American consumerism and capitalism in the 19th century?
Right, okay, so where does this paper situate us? Well, very specifically, it situates us in the New York City draft riots, which take place in July of 1863 in the middle of the American Civil War. These riots were and are, I think, to this day, still the most expensive riots that an American city has ever experienced. They kick off because, you know, President Lincoln institutes the draft for the Union Army. And this is actually, it's not just unpopular in New York, it's unpopular in multiple sites across the northern US, but it's particularly unpopular in New York, where there is a big white working class population that feel, and particularly an Irish working class population that feels very keenly, they've got no interest in signing up to fight on behalf, as they see it, of for the black man for emancipation. It's also sort of, I guess, whipped into further frenzy by the politics of the city, which has got a sort of profound democratic ties in municipal government. So all those things together sort of create a perfect storm. And the paper is set against the backdrop of those 4 days of riot in New York. But in particular, it's set against the backdrop of what happens after those riots. And you asked me about historiography. And so I'd say one thing I think that this project that I'm doing takes a look at is the aftermath of riot. There's been some really great books about the New York City draft riots. Ivor Bernstein's book, Adrian Cook's book. I mean, Tyler Anbinder writing about New York in the 19th century, he gets us into riots too. So, you know, people know about these riots. Actually, when I tell people what I'm working on, I say, have you ever seen the, you know, Gangs of New York? It's that big riot at the end. So there's been quite a lot of work done on these riots, but very little, I think, on the aftermath of the riots, and in particular, very little done on how the working class population kind of rebuilt their lives. So that's the sort of micro history context of the project. The bigger context for the project is that it's a book that is looking at the ways in which Americans have dealt with the problem of losing property and loss and property more generally. And I think that when you survey broadly scholarship on property in American history, you tend to see two areas where people have focused. One is the history of rights. Property is often referred to as a bundle of rights. So it's a sort of, you know, a scholarship around how do people acquire those rights? What do those rights allow you to do? Or there's been scholarship on property that looks at sort of the unequal distribution of property, right? Who has it, who doesn't? Processes of dispossession, particularly in the US context, thinking about Native American dispossession. The way I've approached this project is to think about property in a slightly different way, which is to think about it not as a bundle of rights, but as a collection of feelings. How does property make one feel? How are you supposed to feel about property? Who has charge of that sort of emotional regime, if you like? How is it constructed? And what does it mean to live outside of it? So I think the project works on those two different levels. One, the sort of really compelling story of people who went through the riots, and the other, a more sort of cultural and intellectual project about how to understand the way in which people think and feel about property in the 19th century.
Brilliant, yeah. And was there a particular methodology then you wanted to adopt? You talked about emotions and rights. Does this give you a particular angle into the archives? Was there a certain type of finding you wanted to make? There's clearly an interdisciplinary quality to a lot of this work. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. Okay, so methodology is something I've really struggled with actually on this project. I don't know, I'm thinking about people who might be listening to this, thinking about the process of putting projects together. So I will be very honest about that process. Part of this, the sort of the impetus for this project was actually not finding something about the New York City draft riots. It was looking at an attack on a city called Chambersburg in the middle of the American Civil War. So a similar idea. I was kind of interested in what happened to the people who were attacked and their city was burned down and how they went about making claims. So then I thought, well, okay, where else might I see this claims process? I was interested in this claims process. And I thought about the draft riots as a moment of acute property loss, went to the New York Historical Society on a sort of fishing trip, really, and came across the most astonishing collection of records, because the city was liable, because of a law that they had passed in 1855, to make restitution, to indemnify everybody who lost property in the riots, which meant that there were nearly 2,000 individual records of individual claimants who came forward seeking indemnification for their property loss. So in some ways, you said, where does the methodology start? The project started there with that archive. And I think projects often start with both a question and an archive, and then it's the question of how do you bring those things together? The question of feeling came about partly, again, thinking about how you get influenced by things. I am working still at Queen Mary University of London, where we have this amazing Centre for the History of Emotions. And so, I'd be talking to colleagues and hearing seminar papers and thinking about sort of how they were approaching some of these issues about, emotions, history. Big questions in that field include, are emotions innate? These are the kind of biological, we feel five basic emotions kind of scholars. The history of emotions people talk about emotions evolving and being a sort of a component of power regimes, essentially. And I found that really compelling. And I found it even more compelling when I realized that what I was seeing in those archives, in those accounts and the claims that people were making, were these deeply emotional frameworks that were coming out of those sources, whether that was to do with how people place value on things, whether it was to do with how they were claiming sympathy, which is part of what you read from the project this time, whether it was to do with how they talked about their fears or their terrors as to what had happened, and then realizing that the way in which the claims were being processed was trying to strip all of that emotion out of the claims process. So I think the methodology takes a lot from the history of emotions sort of scholarship, if you like, but it also came out of the kind of the ways in which the people I was hearing their voices from those claims were sort of grappling with the problem of emotions and property.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to jump in on that notion of the history of emotions, because your manuscript makes clear that lawmakers in many cases saw sympathy as a threat to the foundations of the property order, or that they were trying to put the protection of private property beyond the reach of a sympathetic challenge. Do you think that the attempt to banish sympathy in rioting and fugitive slave rendition cases was an attempt by lawmakers to build a hierarchy of emotional value? That the emotional value of property ownership should come before and should trump emotional solidarity with those that threaten this property order?
Yes, I mean, I think that's a huge part of it, absolutely. And I like the way you've sort of framed that as a hierarchy of emotions, because I think that's true. In one way, the only conclusion you can come to reading through all of this is it's a failed project in many ways. You cannot banish emotions from the courtroom or from the judicial process or even from the process of enacting laws. It's an impossibility. But I think the fact that they try it is very significant. And I think you're right that there is a hierarchy here about what kind of, not just what kind of emotions are legitimated, but whose emotions are legitimated. And certainly class plays a huge part in that story. there is going back to Enlightenment thinking about emotions, the idea that people who are of a higher class or well-educated, certainly who are white, are better able to articulate and control their emotions, and therefore their emotions are to be more respected, certainly. But I think in certain cases, with the fugitive slave cases, for example, the emotions of slaveholders who are white and well-educated are still problematic, like, for example, in that Lemon case. And so even then, you find the judges, like Elijah Payne, is struggling with that problem of, well, how do I manage emotion in my courtroom as a result?
I'm glad you brought up the Lemon case and the fugitives, because we're going to ask now about the notion of the extent of Northern sympathy with fugitive slaves balanced against Southern and Northern Democratic attempts to weaponize the notion of the South as needing sympathy, or that the Southerners presenting themselves as under threat from Northern aggression, whether that's from an insurgent Republican Party or from abolitionism more generally. Do you think that your research in this topic shows that the excising of sympathy could ever be a politically neutral process, or does this always privilege some groups at the expense of others, those that have power, those that are trying to challenge power?
That's a really great question. And I think the answer is it's never a politically neutral process. And it is often a process that ends up deeply privileging and providing huge advantage to certain groups. And to an extent, I think what I'm simply charting is who takes control of an understanding of emotion, a language of emotion at certain points, and is able to use it effectively to accomplish what they think are the right ends. In the case of those judges, I think the ends that they were seeking was a more stable, more calm, less volatile courtroom, certainly. And it's absolutely clear to me that that also ties in with the end of protecting property interests for the most part. The Lemon case is extraordinary because it doesn't protect property interests in that particular moment. But for the most part, I think of, you know, for example, the example of Baldwin, the early case, the Caleb Johnson case, or even going all the way to the sort of Passmore Williamson case. Those were examples where property was being protected through this kind of stabilization of, you know, emotions within the courtroom, the sort of the draining of sympathy. Where they clearly ran into problems was when they were trying to legislate around riots and found that property owners' interests were not being protected by the language of sympathy, because they felt, you know, lawmakers felt compelled to listen to those voices who were actively, you know, protesting against the presence of abolitionists or Catholics, or in some cases just black communities within their bounds. So it's a real contest, I think, over who takes control over sympathy. In that sense, it can't be either partisan political neutral, nor can it be politically neutral with, you know, sort of a little p politics thinking about power. Definitely not.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the enslaved themselves. I mean, this is evidently largely a top-down story of legal dictums and so on. But how do the defendants themselves understand the attempt to excise all this sympathy from the courtrooms? And do they develop strategies of resistance to cope with that legal tendency?
That is such a great question, and one I wish I had like more evidence to offer a good answer. I think the small glimpses that you can get, and here I would, you know, draw on the kind of work done by scholars like Marissa Fuentes, where they sort of read us along the archival grain, essentially. And, you know, so where do I see glimpses of how the enslaved themselves cope with this? In the Lemon case, there was one really interesting moment where the reporters described Juliet Lemon, who was the sort of enslaved, the enslaved women's owner, going over to the two women, Emmeline and Nancy were their names, and they're quite young women, they're only in their early 20s, and they have been enslaved by this woman for 15 years. And Juliet Lemon is said to beg Emmeline and Nancy not to do this to the family. Why would you do this? And the reporters claim that the two enslaved women wept. And I thought, What are they doing in that moment? I mean, it's very difficult anyway when you're working with emotions, and we haven't really talked about that, but it is, of course, there's a difference between the sense of prescribed emotion and then what we might call the sort of felt emotion. But in that moment, those tears could be read in a number of ways. And actually, my colleague Thomas Dixon does a brilliant article on tears in the courtroom in the British context called The Tears of Judge Wiles, if anyone wants to follow up on this. But have you? Excellent. Okay. Did I put it in the notes?
We will.
Okay, good. Okay. And you can cut that bit from them. I can't remember what I put in my footnotes. So he talks about how people see tears. Now, this is a hugely emotionally charged moment. The black population of New York has all turned out to watch. Even if they're not allowed in the courtroom, they're all crowded into the corridors and in the vestibules and they're on the staircases. So what did those tears mean? What was she, was she genuinely expressing fear that this case might fail, and she was, they would be in a terrible situation having attempted this and failed and still be enslaved? Was it genuine regret that she might be parted from a mistress, in the terminology that Juliet Lemon would have understood, a sort of a kind and benevolent mistress? Or was it, and I think this sort of talks to your question about tactics, a recognition that sympathetic viewers were watching, that the jury themselves might have been moved, and Judge Payne might have been moved to see these two young women crying in his courtroom. Maybe all three. I mean, that's very hard to say, but I think it's without doubt, enslaved people also understood the language of sentiment. They recognized the power of sympathy, and they have seen repeatedly, particularly communities in the North, that it has the power to move people. So I don't think that they were ignorant by any means of the way in which sympathy could function. But if they did see the inside of a courtroom, obviously that's a different, they might not have understood or had experience, or I suspect they would have understood it quite quickly, but they might not have had experience of seeing the effort to keep sympathy out of courtrooms. But they would certainly have understood how it worked outside of courtrooms, I think. Be hard to miss.
If I'm allowed to go off script for a second and ask just a follow-up question to that. The Lemon case in particular, I've always learned about it and studied it always with the shadow of Dred Scott hanging over it, and the notion of, is the Lemon case going to be the next Dred Scott for the United States? Mm. Can slavery survive no matter where it's limited based on any a precedent that could be set in this case? Mm. And I wonder, building on your notion of how formerly enslaved or enslaved communities can use sympathy to their advantage in this notion, how far do you think the public outcry in the North to issues like Dred Scott or to the violence in Kansas in the years before is kind of in the background of everyone's decisions at this point, that many people on many sides of these political questions all know that the emotional outcries have been building in the last few years in the United States, and that they have as good a chance as any at this point to make an impact emotionally?
Okay, with the Lemon case, and you mentioned it as a comparator with Dred Scott, you're absolutely right that people are following this case all the way through the 50s and wondering whether it is going to ignite in the same way that it does, that Dred Scott does as well. And I think one of the things that stops it actually from becoming quite as incendiary as Dred Scott does is that in New York, the state law is so clear, whereas I think in some ways, I think I'm right in saying the Dred Scott decision is more about the territories, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think there is one of the reasons that the governor of Virginia, I think it's Governor Wise, probably chooses not to push it as far as it could go, doesn't go up to the Supreme Court, is partly because at that moment, particularly, they don't want to start undermining state law.
Right.
And that is exactly what the Lemon case hinges on, really. Elijah Payne is very, very clear that, you know, although he looks to constitutional law and he goes to, you know, Vattel and Pufendorf, but no, really the key thing here is it's New York state law. New York has abolished slavery. That's the you can't quibble with that. Whereas, you know, it was a harder needle to thread, really, for Dred Scott. And I think that is to do with the fact that it was to do with territorial law. But it's, I mean, they're definitely watching it and they're wondering whether it's going to do the same thing. And in fact, the case is finally resolved in 1860. Yeah. So it goes right down to the wire.
Yeah, I suppose the one thing that no lawmaker wants to take a firm stance on is basically the Freedom National Doctrine, or whether slavery can survive depending on state law or not. And if they just try and get it solved before they get to that explosive judgment, it's better for both sides involved, even if they then feel somewhat incomplete in their verdict.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think everyone ultimately takes their foot off the gas, essentially, to avoid going over the edge, just to complete the metaphors. Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing that that comes through in your manuscript is occasional moments of anti-Catholic instances, particularly in 1844, but also in the 1834 Urschlein riots. So that led us to both think about how, when we understand sympathy, to what extent are we seeing this through the eyes of the majority community, not necessarily the Catholic minority within the body politic? For the community to be obligated in times of loss, do you first have to fulfill your obligation to the community by conforming to their values? So to what extent do you see sympathy in the 19th century as conditioned or limited by religious or cultural prejudice?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Great question again, because I think that's exactly what's happening with the two instances that you picked out. Absolutely. And there's huge, and particularly in the case of the burning down of the Ursuline convent, there is huge controversy, which I sort of cut for the purposes of the length of this paper. But really, you see it as a debate playing out between those who have sympathy for property and those who have sympathy for the community, who wish to exclude Catholics because they don't think they are worthy of sympathy. So it's sort of layered sympathy, if you like. But it's absolutely clear, particularly when it comes to riot law, the problems that each state faces in that, in the sort of resolving how to manage those outbursts of violence, are to what extent do they have sympathy for that violence because they recognize that the community doesn't want to include those people that they see as they cannot have any sympathy with themselves. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is no sympathy for, not sympathy in the sense of compassion or pity, which I think is one of the problems that I continue to sort of work on with this paper, but sympathy more in the 18th century sense, a feeling alongside of an identification of similar feelings, the Greek word compassion, which is the sort of same thing, it means with feeling, so you know, feeling alongside, feeling with, and that's I think what 18th century politicians meant when they talked about sympathy, and that's the kind of sympathy that legislators are respecting when they see rioters refusing to respect the rights of Catholic property owners, definitely.
And it's fascinating that if you read the Irish sources during the 1844 riot in particular, particularly Irish American newspapers, they're very much playing into that 18th century notion of community, or that they say that it's the vast majority of the American people are not these visceral anti-Catholic nativists, and this is a small minority that they themselves, whilst claiming to represent the body politic, are the truly ones that need to be excluded because they represent a more kind of almost old world view of belonging that the United States is trying to push beyond. And something that's comes through throughout this manuscript and throughout our conversation is this kind of questionable idea of how far can sympathy ever be truly controlled? I mean, when we think about the fugitive slave renditions and the figures in the background are these democratic mobs that do not have the same sympathy for the fugitives, or that say, you know, we have to put aside our personal sympathies to, you know, for the higher good of preserving the Union. And it's a similar kind of thing going on with the Irish rioters in 1863. A lot of people saying, we abhor the violence, but we have to kind of understand and look beyond it before, because these men are also potentially keeping the Union going in their service. So sympathy in general is something that we, I guess, on a day-to-day basis, don't think very much about as something that, that requires a kind of regulation or influence to allow it to continue to exist, that it's not something that just develops, but it's something that can be maybe influenced and controlled by other people. So do you think that comes through in the sources that you've been using in this manuscript?
The question is, are people thinking about regulating their sympathies and other people's sympathies throughout?
Yeah, and how successful can they ever actually be in doing that?
Right, absolutely. Well, I think there are two arenas where those questions are, you know, clearly very pertinent. One is, and then I think that's why I focused on them for this part of the paper. One is in the courtroom and the other is in the sort of the halls of public governance. And the reason to focus on those two things is because, as your question implies, you can't really regulate sympathy outside of those places, because they're even less control, you know, those spaces, those broader public spaces, not to mention private spaces, which I will get to into the next chapter. But, you know, in terms of public spaces, those are so ritualized and formal that they offer the opportunity to regulate sympathy in certain ways. I think beyond that, it becomes, you know, particularly in the press, for example, it's very difficult to regulate feeling. And or to try and regulate feeling, and you know, in broader public debate, it's very difficult to do, and you certainly can't do it in, you know, taverns and coffee shops, and people's feelings will out. But I think what's interesting about the fact that they are trying to do it in courtrooms and in, you know, offices of City Hall and so on, is that it taps into a broader history that I think we've sort of, or at least I think could deserves a better telling, which is that when 18th century political economists think about, you know, how to govern, for them, feeling is at the center of that. If you think about how Adam Smith's, you know, theory of moral sentiments comes before the Wealth of Nations, it's because you need to think about how people feel, how to regulate your passions. And I mean, he's at the tail end of that Enlightenment project. You know, this is the question that Enlightenment philosophers are thinking about when they try and think about governance. By the 19th century, those questions have sort of disappeared, actually. And one of the things I think that I'm seeing is that questions about feeling, certainly about sympathy, are being moved into the private sphere. And that was really the kind of historical riddle that I set out to try and unpack. I don't necessarily think it's about whether the project is successful or unsuccessful in terms of actually doing the regulation. I think it's the fact that they're addressing themselves to these questions that I want to pay attention to.
And so what do you see then are the wider resonances of this story? Where does it take us further into the 19th century or beyond?
Oh.
What is it really that's so transformational?
Can I come back in a year and answer that? I think the big transformation that I'm seeing is this turn away from making feeling a project of public concern. Particularly feelings like happiness and fulfillment, which I look at in the first chapter, about fear and how to manage fear, which increasingly becomes privatized, sympathy, certainly, and then in later chapters I look at the kind of emotional value, intimacy and love, I've sort of labeled it for now, that people have in how they attach themselves to their things. All of those over time, I think I'm seeing being moved into the private sphere. And I think what it's telling me, anyway, is that, an intensification of a market economy could not cope with those kinds of feelings. It simply wasn't, whether it was legal or whether it was through sort of commercial dealings, feeling became a problem. And so whether it's the judiciary or lawmakers or, you know, commercial actors trying to create contracts with one another, they're moving feeling into the private sphere. But I don't think that makes those feelings disappear. So I suppose for me the point of the project is to say, first of all, to notice that that's happened, to say that we haven't found necessarily then a solution for dealing with how people feel about their things and especially how they deal with loss, and that that has a huge impact on how we imagine and how we think about how we might deal with loss today. And one of the scholars that I've looked at and found really interesting in this sense is a legal scholar. I'm going to not say her name right, but her name is Bernadette Atuene, I think she pronounces it. But she talks about dignity reparations. This is something that she looked at for South Africans who lost all of their property under apartheid regimes, and saying it's not enough simply to give people a, you know, property value in terms of, you know, dollars back when you're talking about reparations. We need to recognize all the ways in which property structure us as people. How does property relate to personhood in this emotional way? And if we don't recognize that those have been, as it were, written out of history, we can't write them back in. So I'd say that, you know, historically, I think the project is looking at how law and capitalism in the 19th century kind of worked together to move emotions into a very sort of private sphere and make them personal problems, essentially, but also hopefully to provide just a different perspective on thinking about how we as a society deal with losing property.
Right. And lastly then, if we can ask this, what are you hoping to work on next?
Ooh. Okay, so sometimes when I just think, what would I really most like to do? I'd love to write a history of creativity. I'm really fascinated at the moment with the debates that are going on around AI. I think most people who work in any part of any profession where, who's not interested in AI? I mean, right, like there's the extreme conspiracy theorists who think, you know, we're only weeks away from being taken over by robots. But I think there's a really big question here about, you know, what does, when confronted with technological change, what are the things that we most value, that we want to hold on to, that we'll fight to keep, and how will we adapt? And I think creativity sort of sits at the heart of that question in many ways. And it begs the question, well, you know, what is creativity? And so obviously as a historian, my answer is, well, let's look at that in a historical context. And I did that most scholarly, you know, action of putting the word creativity into Google Ngram, because I believe that will give you all the answers. But it is astonishing. It's a word that doesn't really pop up until the 20th century. So I thought that was quite suggestive. And anyway, that's maybe a next step. But that's, again, a really enormous project. So I don't know if that's something I'll take on. But right now, with everything that's going on around us, that really I find kind of an interesting question to think about.
Jo, thanks so much for being with us here today. And Rob?
Thank you.
Thank you both.